Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. It's Friday, June 14th. I'm Stephen Overly. Steve Ballmer owns the LA Clippers. He's also the former CEO of Microsoft and still one of the company's largest individual shareholders, putting his net worth somewhere around $130 billion. But yesterday, he came to Politico.
How's that?
To join me in our windowless podcast room.
Better. Okay.
To talk about a venture he launched 7 years ago. The nonprofit USA Facts. It collects government data and tries to make it more consumable. And this is something near and dear to Ballmer. Because, as you're about to hear, Ballmer is a numbers guy.
I like numbers because I like numbers.
Like a numbers guy.
But also, I think they are much less partisan than adjectives.
And he wants people, especially politicians, to spend more time with them.
You need 10 to 15 minutes of people's actual concentration to make a difference. I mean, what we're going to see, we're actually going to try putting six different topics, 15-minute videos on TV. It'll be cheap TV. We're not going to be in 15 minutes during the NBA finals.
He came armed with the latest annual report from USA Facts.
There's a couple things in the slides.
And wanted to go through it.
Here's an example. All right. What is happening with people?
Now, maybe it comes as no surprise that the ex-CEO of Microsoft finds so much beauty in an Excel spreadsheet. It's clear, though, he sees numbers as his own answer to political partisanship wrecking America, especially amid a divisive presidential election. So on the show today, Ballmer on AI, political disinformation, and why numbers will save us all. Here's our conversation. Hey, Steve, welcome to Politico Tech.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course, you're known for being an animated guy. There's, video of you dancing with Bill Gates at the Windows 95 launch, screaming for the Clippers when they pull out a win. Is there anything you're seeing in tech now that gets you that excited?
Yeah, everybody talks about it, but it's true. The promise of AI is an incredible thing. And if you talk about many of the, people would ask me 10 years ago when I was retiring from Microsoft and before that, what's the new frontier of tech? And I used to say, it's when you can, tell your computer something like, get me ready for my trip to see customer X.
Right.
With AI, you can do that kind of stuff. We're now at that frontier. I'd been kind of hoping for it, way back in the 2000s, if you will, but we're there.
I like to talk to people who have some perspective in tech because often everything can feel so new, but there are people who have seen a lot of this before. Now that we're in the early days of AI, how does this compare to the early days of the internet?
Let me start with the following. In the short term, it is probably overhyped.
Okay.
And in the long term, it's way underhyped. And I think the same thing was true of the move to the internet, the move to the PC, the move to the smartphone. I'd probably call the move to the cloud. I would probably call those the five big, sort of sea changes over the last 50 years.
Right.
And in the short run, most of them, I think, were overestimated. In the long run, underestimated. And it feels like that. And will AI be bigger than all of those? That's what people say right now, because it's the latest thing. But if you think back and say, wow, have phones made a big difference? Wow. Has being able to do computing yourself made a big difference? Yeah, tremendously. And this one will be tremendous also.
You said overhyped in the short term. What do you see as overhyped about AI right now?
I mean, people are jumping on it, innovating. That's good. But then you'll get the blowback. Well, it didn't do that well on what I asked it to do. Or, it brought back data that I know is wrong. You'll hear that.
Right.
And so while people are excited about the chance to innovate, you will get people who have a skeptical view and can find reasons to be vindicated in their skeptical views.
It certainly seems like now there is a lot more risk compared to the start of the internet, or at least greater awareness of the risks, right? Misinformation, inequality, polarization. Do you think the concerns about AI making all of that worse are warranted?
I think there are concerns that will play out. I think there'll be a role for innovation to contain those risks. I mean, just think about, we do have security software on the internet. It's not perfect, but it's sure a whole lot better than it used to be. There will be different issues in the AI world than there were, you know, in some of the earlier things, that some of the earlier innovations. And so I don't say it is wrong for people to worry about those things. I think people can overblow them in the short term and miss some of the benefits. And there will be, quote, bad things that happen. Is it easier to do deep fakes? Sure, it's easier to do deep fakes than it used to be. Is that a bad thing? Yes, that's a bad thing. Were there deep fakes before? Yes. Will this make it worse? Yes. You know, so we need the appropriate tools to, so to speak, go after the bad guys and make sure that the laws clearly outlaw, if you will, bad behavior. But with that said, the amount of productivity you can gain, our USA Facts effort, where we try to pull together government data and make it understandable, we will be so much more productive, therefore have so much more content. It doesn't mean there'll be no human being involvement, but the ability to go get the data, to analyze it, to publish it, wow, we'll be able to do a lot more than we are, you know, currently with the resources we have.
I do want to ask about your work with USA Facts, because I do think there's a lot of intersections between that and what we're seeing right now with tech and AI. One more question for you, though, because, you know, you just mentioned laws. You became the president of Microsoft, I think, in 1998, if I remember right. So you sort of, again, lived a lot of this experience around Washington's scrutiny of tech, right? The congressional hearings, the antitrust investigations, you know, you've lived it. How well do you think Washington is handling AI and the regulation of it?
I think fine for now. Just fine.
Good.
I'll go further than that. Do we need regulation right now? I think that would be perhaps ill-advised. Do we need clear legal framework to go after bad guys? Yes. I think, you know, I had a good meeting with a bipartisan group of senators yesterday. That's clearly on their mind. I think that's fantastic. Do we need technology regulation that would start in a legislative body? No. I think it's too confusing. Will there be issues that people may choose to look at, parts of the executive branch, and really dive into where there seem to be systematic issues as opposed to an occasional bad guy? Yeah, there probably will be. And the tech industry will probably say, no, we'll solve these on our own.
Right.
Much as I've seen waves of issues, or, hey, that's not really a problem, don't worry, we'll fix it, we'll make it better. And yet, so far, the tech industry has been great working in collaboration. But I think it's more about laws that you can use to prosecute bad guys right now, as opposed to specific regulation. And that, as I said, that really came to me clearly on the discussion we had with senators who really had their mind pretty much in a good place, I would have said.
Is that the advice you gave the senators when you met with them, or what was your sort of feedback as they're thinking about this?
A little different. My feedback was, please don't try to get a bunch of people who don't understand the technology out front putting regulation in place. Take it case by case, go through it, and then generalize later. And then they said, yes, but we're not in a good place. It's not easy, for example, to go after somebody under the law who's made a deep fake. Great. And the combination of those two, I think, will be the right mix.
You know, with your work at USA Facts, as you said, it's really all about making government data and information more accessible, whether that's government spending and other government kind of activity. I talk to people on this podcast who say that we now live in a post-fact, post-truth world. Do you see it like that?
Well, I certainly think the world's in a place where people like make up their mind first and maybe never educate themselves or do it second. That is more prevalent. Are there people out there who still have open minds, who really want to understand what's going on before where they decide where they are? Yes, there are centrists. We don't hear from them as much. They come in perhaps a little bit more open-minded than the far left or the far right, but I do believe those folks are out there. I also believe it's a contribution we can make, because I don't expect the world to stay the way it is for the long run. I have more optimism than that. And we found that for people who we reach, and we had over 12 million visitors last year, which is not tiny. We want to do more. But for the people who reach, they're interested. You know, we just put out our annual report. We think of, how do you communicate clearly about the business of government? It's different than a business,
right?
But how do you do that clearly the same way a business must communicate to its shareholders? We're all kind of shareholders, if you will, in our country, in our government.
Right.
So how do you do that kind of clear communication without exaggeration, without partisanship, without salesy, without forecasting? That's what you have to produce as a business in order for your shareholders to read the objective statement. How do you do the same thing with government? How has government action changed the way people live and their what they can afford? Now, what is happening with the deficit? You can characterize those things. I like numbers because I like numbers, but also I think they are much less partisan than adjectives.
How should the government, or how can the government better communicate that? And I guess I'm going to show my pro-journalism bias here. Is the government even the right communicator for that? Because, you know, I could argue that you need journalists, you need independent voices vetting that sort of information.
I think probably I'd say three things. Number one, government is number one. If they don't, the data government provides, and I'd say this to journalists too, who don't look at the data government provides many times. They'll look at something that a research institute says, and they'll quote the research institute. But research institutes have biases of their own.
Sure.
So go look at the source government data. I heard a guy yesterday at the Department of Commerce saying, we're a wholesaler of data. Now, the retailers, you get journalists who are retailers, think tanks, organizations like ours, and we can put spin on it. We try to not put spin, but journalists will put spin by interview, supplemental study, et cetera. But the source data should come from government, and people should look at it. It drives me crazy when the media doesn't, et cetera. Should government have to present itself somehow in a way where government says, this is what happened in the past. Let's all agree on it. I mean, in my dream, which will never happen, you'd say every member of Congress and the president have to sign a document that's maybe 100 pages long that says, I have read this, I agree it properly summarizes the state of America today and state of government in America by the numbers. Heck, CEOs of businesses have to sign those.
Right.
It makes you accountable for the production of good numbers. That's not going to happen. I'm not
right.
naive about that. But yeah, I think you start with the government numbers, and then people can interpret them in ways that are appropriate. So maybe a little bit more than you implied, but I don't think government should be the only interpreter. You know, certainly you're going to have at least two parties that are going to interpret the same data and express
wildly different ways.
Well, they're just going to say, hey, look, my opinion about what to do is X.
Right.
And Charlie's is Y. What I don't like today is people will not expressly accept what happened in the past, which should be not something of debate, at least not things that you can measure numerically.
This latest report that you've put out is really aimed at members of Congress themselves, sort of putting together numbers about the state of the union, the state of the nation. But like you're saying, we see in politics all the time now, people who just ignore facts that don't suit them. Think of the accusations around stealing the 2020 election, for example, right? As a prime example.
2020 election, which I don't want to go into detail. But the 2020 election is not about numbers that characterize the past. It is about non-numerical stuff.
Right.
It is very different. And the way those facts would be approached should be a whole lot different than, hey, what has happened with housing burdens? You know, what percentage of people now spend 30% or more of their income on housing? It's a very different thing to characterize. We won't go near the 2020 election, not because it's important, but there are folks like you and others who will do that. we try to stick to the things that you can really characterize by the numbers.
Well, I guess with that in mind, I'm curious about the interplay between that non-numerical, you know, distortion of the truth and the cold, hard numbers, facts, and figures. You know, I'm a numbers person myself, but as a reporter, when I get a company's annual report, in addition to looking at the numbers, one of the sections I always go to is risk factors. I like to know what are they worried about. And so when I looked at the 2024 annual report that USA Facts put out, one of the risk factors was social unrest, right? And this idea of domestic extremism. Is your thesis that facts and data can combat that?
I think if, you know, the Daniel Patrick Moynihan, you know, everybody can have their own opinion, but not everybody should have their own facts. James Madison, and I'll get the quote wrong, but a democracy of the people without information or the ability to go get it is, I can't remember, basically says is a farce.
Right.
So yeah, I do think there is a role to play. And numbers, you could say people can disagree about what they mean to them, but at least start with, you know, start with the fact, I'll take foreign aid. Foreign aid is 1% of government spending, okay? And over half of it goes to military aid as opposed to what I think people would characterize as food and other humanitarian support. So number one's military. Number two actually is nation building, democracy. And number three is everything else. Well, I think that surprises people. It, you know, people say, oh, cut the foreign aid budget.
And, right.
And people don't know what it goes for and the fact that it is not a large percentage and will not help as much with the budget deficit as people would say. That's just numerical. That's numerical. Now, do you want to cut the foreign aid budget? Do you want to increase it? No, different people have different opinions on that. But the numbers there serve as a better guide, I think, than anything else. I'd love to have a chance just to take one area where, you know, our numbers may not be all we need in order to make good decisions. And immigration would be a good example of that.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. You know, we care a lot about numbers and being able to present issues by the numbers. Immigration is certainly going to be a prominent issue in the next election. We'd like to present immigration by the numbers. And, you know, there are various estimates and measurements that you'll get from Border Patrol, from DHS more broadly, from Census. But if you really want to be able to describe by the numbers what's going on with immigration, we have border encounters rising at a steep level, but then the estimates of total number of unauthorized immigrants in the country is relatively flat. Being able to really understand, are people overstaying their visas or not? The numbers don't exist. You know, do we really take somebody who's an asylum seeker is allowed into the country? You know, what does that look like? What happens? We can't do the same kind of detailed work. So really being able to characterize that, and I did have a chance to talk to Secretary Mayorkas yesterday, and I think they are aware of the issues, but that's an important issue, and it is a numerical issue. I think the department's doing its best. It's a long-term thing. They've been at improving computer systems over many over a number of administrations. But it's an area where I think not just as citizens, but for good policymaking, it would be really helpful to improve the numbers. I just use that as an example where I think numbers can set you free. There are other areas where I think the numbers are great. This is a particularly tricky one.
You know, you talked about like a dream where government leaders had to sign this document pledging to start with the numbers. If that's not going to happen, is there a change that could be made to the system or to how we go about politics that could actually achieve some of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think there is something that is practical as opposed to something that unfortunately shouldn't be impractical, but I think it's impractical today, which is you could have a requirement through a data act or whatever that every bill that gets passed, the bill has to say, what numbers are we going to look at in the future in terms of gauging this, the numbers won't be everything, and we direct the executive branch agencies to make sure those numbers are collected and reported in reasonable fashion. that is not unrealistic. You know, when you get things like the Data Act and some of the other things that have been pushed and or enacted, that proposal, I think, is not in crazy town like right. the first one I threw out there.
It doesn't sound crazy, but, you know, we'll see what Congress can do, what can get passed. You know, these days, that's a hard thing to do.
I hear you.
I know you're a pretty nonpartisan guy. This is a political...
Well, I do have my own opinions, particularly about issues. I'm not party-based, but I we do a lot of philanthropy to try to focus in on the economic mobility of our population. We are worried about the climate being a threat to our grandchildren. So right. yeah, we do work, some of which is public, but I think thinking of it as all party-based is not the right way, at least for me to think about it.
Right. I have this thought I keep coming back to often, that a lot of issues now have been politicized, even though they're not political. And I think that winds up distorting a lot of the conversations around them. But let me appeal then to that side of you, that work you're doing. You know, you must be following what's going on with the 2024 election and how everything is playing out now with a rematch of sorts between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. What do you make of that election cycle this time around?
I think it's challenging, because in this time, as you called it, it's a rematch. I think you're going to get far less real consideration of substantively what the candidates are saying. Obviously, the record could be a lot more valuable. There is a record of what Trump did. There is a record of what Biden did. People can actually think about those things if they're willing to take a little bit of time and assess them. I think we're going to have less of that in this election. You know, you could say you can have a policy battle in an election. My wife likes to point out sometimes, you know, less affluent people will have issues with more affluent people. You've seen that in some revolutions in history. And you can have sort of a culture war. This feels more like a culture war to me than it does policy and action, or even something that is split strictly on economic issues, if you will.
Has that influenced at all the philanthropy you're doing or the causes that you're working on?
Yeah, I mean, the bulk of what we support is in our two areas, but you can consider USA Facts a philanthropic effort to try to support democracy in a nonpartisan way.
Right.
You know, if you're going to train election officials in a nonpartisan way on just how to do their jobs, because nobody provides training to people, there will be some activities of that sort that we'll look at.
So are you putting any money or donations or anything behind a particular candidate?
I am not. Well, yeah. That's not true. There's a lady who worked for me at Microsoft who's running again for the House of Representatives, and she's always been great. Her husband worked for us too. So yeah, of course, I'll support her. But basically the answer is no, not doing that.
Why? I'm curious. I should know this, but have you never gone into that?
Oh, I think 20 years ago. 30 years ago now. I did a little bit, but I would say a couple things. Number one, my mind is driven by issues. And usually no candidate would agree with me on even half the issues. It's sort of split out. Number two, this is a contribution, a nonpartisan contribution that we're trying to make. And number three, I mean, people focus a lot on money and fundraising and how that determines elections. I'm a little less convinced of that, I would say. And I can go vote. That's my partisan activity.
Just
I can
vote. Yeah.
And that's my private set of decisions, as it is every other American citizen. So I don't avoid voting. I don't.
There's something I've been hearing a lot about lately. I'm sure you've read about this too, which is in the tech world among investors and executives, sort of a growing support for Donald Trump when, you know, traditionally the thinking has been it's a more liberal voting base. I'm curious, you know, you must talk to tech CEOs and investors. What are you hearing from other folks as they think about this election?
It's funny. I actually don't talk to many tech CEOs. My oh, yeah? world has moved
all
to
basketball.
not for profits.
Okay, yeah.
And of course, basketball. But as a former tech CEO, I would say that companies taking part of in views is tough. you're going to have a shareholder base that is, you know, on both sides, you know, from a party standpoint, on both sides. You're going to have customers that are on both sides. You're going to have employees that are on both sides. So what is the role of the company? The role of the company should be to reflect the interests of the shareholders. And I, in aggregate, I'm going to say that's probably more nonpartisan. We have generally found that employees in tech companies might be a little bit more liberal than not. But at the end of the day, that's not black and white. And the other constituencies, obviously, you sell to people who are on both sides of the issue. So I think people recognize that, and that it's important to know and relate and be able to talk about the needs of the industries to people in a way that is party independent. You know, it's issues. Oh, you asked me about political giving. I have supported ballot initiatives.
Okay.
On things we care about. There was a ballot initiative we put a lot of money into in California that does now allocate a certain percentage of the education budget to arts and kind of to the delivery of arts. Yeah, we supported that. And my wife did. We both did in that instance. And so ballot initiatives, just to be complete. But if you're a tech CEO, you have issues for sure you care about, whether they come to ballot initiatives or not. You have issues you care about. And if the Republicans or the Democrats are in power, the issues don't change. And so having the ability to communicate to either party on that, I think that is the role of a CEO, as opposed to be partisan, unless all their customers, employees, and shareholders are all on one side of an issue.
One last question for you, and you know, the Clippers fans listening would be mad if I didn't work something in on basketball, but I'm going to put a Politico spin on it.
Okay.
Which is, there are people, especially in Washington, who approach politics like sport, right? You've got teams, you know, they break it down as winners and losers. I mean, now that you have your one hand in sort of the sports world, one hand in sort of the upholding democracy world, is there a parallel between the two, and is it positive or not?
There are parallels. Sports is a tribal, you know, this is our team. We don't like any other team. Right. This is our team.
A ruthlessness. Yeah.
So I agree with you. There's a tribal element, but you never need to compromise. It's not like we in the, I'll say the Lakers, because it's the most interesting thing because we're both in the same city. It's not like we have to get together and agree to resolve serious issues. You know, if we want to make a trade with somebody, we can make a trade, and you could say that's a friendly activity because both sides benefit. But at the end of the day, there's no need for compromise. A lot of people may care a lot, but they're not hurt in their day-to-day lives because, you know, we beat the Lakers, which we've been successful at, but they have the championships. I salute them for that. So they are similar in their tribalism. It's just tribalism in sports is safe. It doesn't threaten basic things that are important. You know, our going to war is a little different than what the U.S. government has to process in terms of how it thinks about war, for example.
Right.
You know, I'm happy to say, okay, big game today. We're going to war. But consequences may feel bad for me in that day.
Right.
They're not sort of cosmic societal issues.
Well, listen, Steve, it's been good conversation. Appreciate you joining us on Politico Tech.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here on Monday.